Justin didn't even hesitate. He charged forward, one hand upraised, one arm holding the lost boy tightly to his chest.
"Hold there! No farther! There's trouble below!" he called out.
There was a confusion of shouts and horses as the coachman hauled the carriage to a stop and two guards jumped off the back, swords already drawn. A man stuck his head out of one window, demanding to know what was happening, and Justin could hear a woman's voice, anxious and frightened, sounding inside the carriage. The coachman fumbled for a torch, and there was a sudden, brief, inadequate light. Justin rode forward, the boy balanced between his knees, both hands now lifted to show he offered no threat.
"Go no farther," he warned. "The house below is on fire. The—"
"On fire?"
the man in the carriage cried. "We must go. Maybe we can help. I see it. Look, chassis, through the trees. The sky is all lit up. Hurry!"
"No," Justin said sharply. "Soldiers are there, ready to kill anyone who might arrive. They set the blaze."
"Soldiers?"
the man repeated, and peered hard through the darkness.
"Who are you? What are you doing here? What is... why are..."
But the woman in the carriage was smarter than her companion. She thrust her head out the window beside him, pale and pretty by torchlight.
"Soldiers? From the convent?"
she asked in a breathless voice. Justin nodded.
"Yes. Looking for mystics, I'm guessing, or those who sympathize with them."
"Mystics?"
the man exclaimed, rearing back as if slapped. The woman stilled him with a touch on the arm.
"And they've burned the place down? Everyone in it? Dead? Are you sure? Everyone?"
Justin kicked his horse a few paces closer.
"Except this one. I saw him running and I snatched him up."
But he didn't have to explain the rest. With a muffled shriek, the woman flung herself out of the carriage and stumbled the few paces to Justin's side. The boy stirred in his arms and cried,
"Jesse! Jesse! Jesse!"
Clearly, Justin had found the one safe haven the boy might have in this world, assuming Jesse and her escort had the sense to get away fast. He lowered the boy into Jesse's arms, and they collapsed into a small heap on the ground. Jassy's companion had climbed more slowly out of the carriage, and now he stood staring down at the two on the ground. In a moment, he looked back up at Justin, his face grim.
"Hunting mystics, are they?" he said in a quiet voice. "Coralinda Giseltas is going to have to spread a wider net than that if she wants to catch them all." "And I think she is prepared to do so," Justin said. "You must leave, now. There is nothing you can do for the folks below. Save yourselves. Take this child. Keep going."
The man nodded and put his hands on Jassy's shoulders, pulling her and the boy up and bundling them, still embraced, into the carriage. One foot on the step to climb back in, the man turned around to give Justin a final somber inspection.
"Who are you?" he asked. "You didn't come here by chance."
Justin shook his head.
"I saw the soldiers going by with such stealth, and I was curious. I followed. I never thought to see... to stand by and do nothing."
He shook his head.
"It has been a terrible night," he ended quietly. "More terrible than you know," the man said. "But your part in it, at least, has brought some brightness. His life saved... and certainly ours." "Not if you linger any longer," Justin said. "Go! Tell me your name, at least." "I am in service to the king," he said.
And the man gave a jerky nod and ducked inside the carriage. The coachman and the guards, who all this time had hovered uneasily, resumed their places. In moments, the carriage was turned around and back on the road. Justin stood guard at the intersection until the coach was well and truly out of sight, far enough away that the Lestra's men would not even realize it had come this way. He took one last look over his shoulder, where indeed the sky was a hazy yellow from the fire, and then he nudged his horse forward. One turn, and he was back on the main road,
heading south toward Neft. More tired and more wretched than he had ever been in his life. He had thought he had a fair grasp on cruelty, understood the passions that could drive a man to violence. There had been times in his life he had been none too picky about the methods he employed to get what he wanted, and he was capable of extreme action if he was fighting to stay alive. But he had never engaged in cold-blooded murder. Could not understand what drove a man to try it, especially when there was no immediate gain, no riches to be had, no feud to settle, no insult to avenge, just a desire to eradicate an enemy. An enemy who possessed magic, or tolerated magic, or loved someone who did. Someone who was different. Not a threat, except to a way of life. Offering no harm except a point of view. Those people were dangerous in the Lestra's eyes. Justin rode slowly home, wearier by the mile. The only solution was to grow even more dangerous to the Lestra than she thought the mystics were, to draw her attention, to fight back. Chapter 9. Seneth was sweating and out of breath when Koval called a halt to their workout. The rider, a tall, lean man whose black hair had given way only partly to silver, sheathed his sword and gave her an approving nod.
"Better," he said. "You've been practicing."
"Lifting weights," she said, wiping a sleeve across her face. It was early autumn and cool enough outside that most people were shivering, not sweating. But most people hadn't just spent an hour in the training yard of a palace trying to prevent Koval from killing them.
"I'm getting stronger, but I'm still not as fast as you are."
He gave her a spare smile.
"You'll never be as fast as I am."
She laughed. He wasn't bragging. He was merely telling the truth. She would never be as fast as any of the riders, although she had nearly defeated one of the younger men a couple of days ago. Her finest moment in the weeks since she had begun regular workouts with the King's Elite.
"My goal is to defeat Taze someday," she said, a challenge in her voice. "Will I ever achieve it?"
"No," he said simply. "There are days that I can, or Hammond, or even Tyr, but not 2 days in succession. You'll never be that strong."
They began walking slowly toward the big building where all their practice gear was housed, and where they trained in truly inclement weather. Though Seneth had found herself training outdoors in rain and sleet and in biting wind, and the riders hadn't seemed to find any of those conditions inclement.
"What about Justin?" she asked.
Koval nodded. "Justin's not as good as Taze, but he will be. When he's Taze's age, no one will be able to touch him."
"If he lives that long," Seneth wanted to say.
A soldier's life was chancy at best, and if they really did find themselves in a war, the riders would all be in the heart of it, battling to defend their king. It was a gloomy thought.
"Well, I hope he hasn't realized that," she said lightly instead. "He's already too sure of himself."
Koval laughed. A rider named Janny came jogging up, inviting Koval to a match, and the older man turned away to spar with her. Seneth continued trudging toward the open door of the great shed. Tyr was leaning against the outside wall, 1 foot against the building, arms crossed on his chest. He resembled his son so much that Seneth always had to look again to make sure it wasn't Taze standing there, mysteriously aged by 20 years, but still powerful, still watchful, still wrapped in an aura of brooding menace. Tyr had not been interested in the slightest when Taze told him he had found the woman he loved, but he had paid Seneth some attention when she started working out with the riders, and from time to time he had offered her a critique of her stance or her swing. His comments always proved to be both accurate and helpful. She knew he didn't care if she broke his son's heart, but if she was going to be in any way involved in protecting the king, He wanted her to be invincible.
"How'd I do?"
she asked him now, slowing to a stop. He gave his head a quick, negative shake.
"You fight like someone with a knife up her sleeve," he said.
That made no sense. Every soldier carried a variety of blades. Who knew when one might be lost or batted away?
"I don't know what that means," she said.
"You don't care if you lose the first bout. You know you have another weapon. But that's a dangerous way to fight. It almost always means you will forfeit the first round."
He wasn't talking about weaponry. He was talking about magic. Seneth knew that if her opponent outfenced her, she could drop her sword and call up fire.
"You're right," she said slowly. "I'll try to change my attitude."
"But your swing is improving," he said, almost grudgingly. "You're gaining power."
"More to work on."
"There always is."
She left him in the training yard, dropped her practice sword in its allotted slot, and walked slowly from the training yard to the palace. She had already requested the maids to bring a tub and a few buckets of water to her room, ready to be used whenever she returned from her workout. She didn't care if the water was cold. She'd bathed in her share of freezing mountain streams during her travels, and anyway, she could warm it with a touch. But she had to be clean. She had two appointments today, equally important in her eyes, one with the king, one with Taze's mother. She bathed quickly and changed into more conventional clothes than she usually wore, a simple blue dress that accented her gray eyes and her short, pale, flyaway hair, sturdy walking shoes, a cloak to ward off the chill, and she was ready to stroll the length of Gosenhal. There was a knock on the door, followed immediately by Taze's entrance. It amused her still that he never just walked in, though this suite of rooms could be as truly called his as hers, since he slept here almost every night. They had not exactly gotten around to discussing what their long-term living arrangements should be. Seneth was perfectly willing to take up residence in one of the tiny cottages that dotted the grounds behind the riders' barracks, cottages set aside specifically for the few riders who bothered to marry. But Taze seemed to feel that a Saramara of the 12 houses should be living in a palace, and was unwilling to install her in such humble quarters. And, of course, they were not married.
"You look pretty," he told her.
She laughed.
"I'm trying to look demure."
"My mother likes you. You don't have to try to create an impression."
"Your mother has no idea what to think of me," Seneth wanted to say. "I think it makes her more comfortable to see me in women's clothing," she said, "instead of my boots and my trousers, with my sword on my hip."
He shrugged.
"You are what you are."
"And she is glad that someone loves you, because you never allowed her to love you," Seneth thought.
She was still amazed most days that he allowed Seneth to do so. "I need to be back within a couple of hours," she said. "Baron has asked for a meeting." Taze opened the door, and they stepped into the hall and headed in a leisurely fashion for the stairs. Seneth loved the sensation of walking beside him. She was a tall woman, but he was so big he made her feel almost dainty. Yet he moved with such grace that she always tried to match him, taking smooth, gliding paces and minimizing the noise of her passage.
"What was my father saying to you as you left the training yard?" he asked.
She laughed.
"He said I fight like a mystic, not a soldier."
Taze thought that over for a minute, reconstructing the probable conversation.
"If he'd ever seen how a mystic fights, that would be a compliment," he said at last.
"Someday I'll set him on fire," she said. "That will make him respect me."
He was grinning as they stepped onto the broad porch and down the marble stairs to the courtyard of the palace.
"Then he'll regret any unkind observations he's made in the past."
They talked idly as they crossed the courtyard, saluted the guards at the gate, and set out for Taze's mother's house.
Both of them were familiar with the districts of Gosenhall that were edgy and dangerous, but their route didn't take them there this day. Instead, they traveled wide avenues lined with pretty stone houses and crossed through small common squares decorated with trees and fountains. The day was cool, but fine. Gosenhall, always a charming city, seemed to preen and glitter in the light. Taze's mother lived in a modest but well-kept house, shoulder to shoulder with almost identical buildings, distinguished mostly by a riotous garden, now filled with fading flowers. She was waiting for them at the door, as Seneth imagined she had been waiting since dawn. Nothing made her happier than Taze's appearance on her walk.
"Come in, come in. Oh, it's such a beautiful day. Don't you hate to think it'll get cold so soon?"
she greeted them, throwing her arms around her son. He towered over her, and he returned the hug carefully. She was small-boned and short, rather plump now, but Seneth guessed she had been a tiny wisp of a thing when Tyr first caught sight of her 40-some years ago. She was still attractive in a very ordinary way, with hair of an indeterminate shade of light brown and eyes as dark as Taze's. "Hello, Carol," Seneth said, when the woman reluctantly let go of her son and turned to her other visitor. She was taken in a rather less enthusiastic embrace, but Carol smiled at her, too. "Have you been well?"
"Little aches. I have a cough in the morning, but otherwise I'm very healthy. Come in, sit down. I made a pie. Will you eat something?"
"I love your pie," Seneth said.
"We can't stay very long," Taze said, and Seneth wanted to kick him. Carol's face fell immediately.
"Long enough for pie, certainly," Seneth said, and Carol brightened again. "We have about an hour, I think."
"Oh, good. Then I'll make some tea as well."
She left them in the parlor and bustled off to the kitchen, casting one hopeful glance at Taze over her shoulder.
"Go help her with the tea," Seneth hissed.
He looked surprised.
"Surely she doesn't need my help."
"It's your company she wants, not your assistance. You, 5 minutes alone with you. Go talk to her."
He shrugged and obeyed. Seneth took a seat on one of the overstuffed chairs, leaned her head against the back, and sighed. She was hardly qualified to tutor anyone else in family relations, she thought. Her own parents were dead, bitterly hated by her for years before they went to their graves. She had only the most tenuous relationship with her brothers now. But it was so obvious that Carol wanted nothing so much as a strong bond with her son. Equally obvious that nothing in her life, in her personality, could claim his attention for long. He tried to be kind to her, because Taze was never deliberately cruel, but nothing about her softness or her longing made an impression on him. He was so completely his father's child.
"Tyr must have loved her once," Seneth thought. "He married her. He had several children with her. Did he just grow tired of her? Did the novelty wear off? Did the affection grow inconvenient?"
Taze had told her that Carol was the one who moved out of the shared cottage by the barracks, taking her daughters with her. But Seneth was entirely certain that Carol was the one whose heart was broken. She had fallen in love with this handsome, powerful, dangerous man. She thought she had domesticated him. She thought he would lay that glittering sword at her feet. But she was the one who had been made over. She was the one who had given up all her illusions.
"You won't change him,"
Carol had said to Seneth the first time they met. Taze had left the room with one of his sisters to go inspect some improvement in the back garden. Her voice had not been hostile, but a little wistful.
"He's too much like his father. He will only love you for so long."
"I don't want to change him,"
Seneth had replied softly, which was both the truth and a lie. He had already changed for her. She wanted him to stay exactly the way he was now. She certainly did not want him to change back.
"And I will take his love for however long he wants to give it.
Don't make him your whole world,
Carol had said, leaning forward and almost whispering in her intensity.
Too late,
Seneth had wanted to say, but she had only smiled and changed the subject. Every time she returned to this small, somewhat sad house, the same conversation replayed through her head, the same questions demanded to be answered.
Will he only love me for a short time and then grow weary? Will I one day be like Carol, lonely and grieving, missing one man for the rest of my life? For once having loved Taze, I will never be able to love anyone else. My heart has been reshaped to the size of his, and no amount of tugging and stomping will ever force it back to the size it was.
A small clatter in the hall, and then Carol and Taze returned, she carrying a tray of desserts and he with the platter of tea things in his hands. Carol was glowing. That rare few minutes of privacy with her son had been the best gift Seneth could ever have given her. Taze carefully set the platter down on a fussy, ornate table by his mother, and then took a seat across from Seneth.
"You pour out the cups, Seneth, while I cut the pie," Carol said. "I like lots of sugar in mine."
Seneth poured Taze's first, though he didn't care much for tea, and looked ridiculous with the fragile porcelain in his big hands. But he took it from her with a smile and watched her as she prepared another cup for his mother. It didn't really matter if Seneth was serving tea or practicing her sword play or lashing out with her hands to conjure up fire. Taze was always watching her, interested in seeing what she would do next. Since the day she had met him, he had studied her with an unvaried fascination. She paused a moment to return his smile.
"I think you will love me till I die," she thought. "And even if you don't, that's exactly how long I will love you."
It was a relief to escape the small house, though the price was a promise to return in a couple of weeks.
"Unless we're gone from Gosen Hall, which I have a feeling we might be," Seneth said, pausing at the front door to hug Carol goodbye. "I think the king might be about to send me out on a mission somewhere, and you know I like to bring Taze with me for protection."
A compliment to her son always set Carol to beaming.
"Yes, you'll be safe no matter where you go if Taze is with you.
That's what I think, too."
"Well, if you leave, let me know you're going and try to come visit as soon as you get back."
"We will," Taze said, giving his mother a farewell kiss. "Take care." And they were free.
A quick walk back to the palace, and Seneth invited Taze to accompany her to her meeting with the king.
"He knows if he wants me to go anywhere, you'll be with me, so you may as well come listen now," she said.
He grinned, nodded, and followed her through the gilded corridors. The king was seated in his study, a small, cluttered room of tall windows, blue furnishings, and piles of maps and papers. Baron himself was a lanky man, with the good-natured smile and unkempt white hair of a lunatic inventor. His brown eyes peered out through smudged spectacles on a world he seemed to find perpetually entertaining. He appeared to be perusing a complex letter when Seneth and Taze entered, and without even looking up, he motioned them to two seats across from his desk.
"Yes, yes, in a minute. I just wanted to read this again. Exactly."
He dropped the paper and gave them a bright smile.
"How is my favorite mystic? I cannot call Taze my favorite rider, you know, because that would cause jealousy among my loyal guard and no end of conflict and recriminations."
Seneth grinned.
"Well, if Kira were to hear you call me your favorite mystic, I think there would be just as much rage and envy."
He waved a thin hand.
"Oh, I whisper to her that she is my favorite, but that I am forced to placate you so you don't burn down my palace."
"Such a wise king," she said. "So adept at keeping his subjects happy."
"And I am about to make you happier," he said. "You're a most restless woman, and yet you've patiently stayed here in Gosen Hall for how many weeks, not complaining about boredom? I appreciate your restraint."
"You want me to go on a mission for you?"
"To Korriban Keep,"
if you would be so kind?"
She nodded. "Surely. What's the news from Marlord Heffel? Is he recovered?"
There had been a convocation of Marlords at Gosenhall just a week ago, but Heffel had not been among those present, prevented from traveling because of a lung infection. Baron picked up the paper again.
"He says he is improving every day, but that's not the most interesting part of this letter. He writes that some of his wife's relatives have come to visit for a few weeks. His wife's relatives, in case you didn't know,
are from the Lirans," Seneth supplied. "I did know. Some of them were visiting last summer when we passed through."
"Apparently there is an endless stream of them, crossing the mountains and trading their goods. One group comes and leaves, then another. I don't understand how any woman could have had so much family."
Seneth was laughing. "They're not all related by blood, I'm sure. There's a close-knit clan network, and any of the Laja Alliance, I think it's the Laja who claim Heffel as kin, would consider themselves to be part of the same family."
Baron put up a hand.
"Please, I cannot keep all the feuds and family straight when it comes to the Lirin folk, but I thought you might find it interesting to talk to some of these fellows."
Seneth leaned back in her chair.
"What would I be talking to them about?"
Baron made a delicate motion with his head.
"War may be coming. We might need allies. The people of the Lirans don't have many ties with the people of Gilengaria, but I have met some of their young men, and they are certainly a contentious breed. Perhaps a few of them would be interested in throwing their lot in with our armies. At any rate, I would rather secure them for our troops than let them be wooed away by Halkon Giseltas for his."
"They might fight for us," Seneth said. "I've considered it before. But you might not raise more than a few hundred men from their ranks."
"Better a few hundred with us than a few hundred against us," Tays commented.
"And they are skilled fighters," Baron added. "Worth recruiting."
Seneth arched her eyebrows. "And when have you been privileged to watch Lirin men showing off their battle skills?"
"Pella and I traveled across the Lirith Mountains about a year before she died," Baron said.
He always spoke the name of his first queen very calmly, but Seneth sometimes wondered what it cost him. By all accounts, he had loved her a great deal.
"We found the people fierce but polite. Pella was completely captivated, and she made several close friends there."
Seneth tilted her head. Pella's death had come quite suddenly. Few people had known the queen was even sick, but perhaps Baron and Pella had known. Perhaps they had crossed the mountains looking for a cure. Among the Lirin women were healers so gifted they could save almost any life, no matter how far gone. Had Baron known that? Had the queen? "I'm glad they treated you well," she said. "They don't always take kindly to strangers, even strangers who call themselves king."
Baron was smiling.
"But I'm a most gracious king," he pointed out. "In any case, perhaps you could persuade them that I'm worth fighting for. Play on whatever sympathies you think they have, and recruit some of those ferocious men from my armies."
Seneth nodded slowly.
"All right. I don't know what success I'll have, but I'm happy to meet with Heffel's in-laws and mention the idea."
"But before you go to Korriban," he said, "you might want to stop in and visit Rafe Storion."
Seneth laughed in disbelief.
"Storion City is in entirely the opposite direction."
"I know, but Rafe was so outspoken when he was here last week, he might appreciate a chance to express his views a second time, rather forcefully, to a smaller audience."
"I don't have much rapport with Rafe Storion," Seneth said dryly. "I don't envision him confiding in me."
"It's the gesture that counts," the king said. "It will please him that I am willing to hear him out, no matter what messenger I send."
"All right. Anywhere else you'd like me to go?"
"Not that I can think of at the moment," he said.
"You realize this is a trip that will take a certain amount of time. It could be weeks before the journey is concluded."
"I understand that. But you must understand that I will be sitting here, impatient to hear what you've learned," he replied. "So come back to Gosenhall as soon as you have anything to report."
She widened her eyes.
"Of course."
The king was not convinced.
I know you. Once you escape from the strict confines of the palace, you'll be reluctant to ever come back. If I let you go now, you won't return for months.
Laughing, she closed her fingers around the pendant she always wore, a flat gold disc meant to represent the sun goddess. That and a moonstone bracelet were the only pieces of jewelry she actually owned. I'll be back the minute my mission is discharged, she promised. I swear by the bright mother's red eye, what could possibly keep me? The evening was taken up with packing a few clothes, visiting the great kitchens for a supply of dried food and other travel essentials, and planning their best route, and bathing, again. Who knew when they would next be indoors at a facility large enough to offer a tub and plentiful water? Seneth washed her hair twice, short as it was, just to make sure it was clean. In the morning, when Taze opened the door, he almost fell over Cammon, who was sprawled on the floor before their room. Catching himself before his heavy foot came down on the boy's stomach, Taze merely gazed down at Cammon with no apparent expression of surprise.
"What are you doing here?" he asked.
Cammon scrambled to his feet. Seneth noted his worn travel clothes and the scruffy leather bag slung over his shoulder.
"I'm coming with you," he said cheerfully.
Taze raised his eyebrows, utterly expressionless, but Seneth could tell he was deeply amused.
"You are? Where are we going?"
Cammon waved a hand.
"Somewhere. South, I think. I couldn't tell exactly."
She could hardly contain her laughter as she came to gaze over Taze's shoulder.
"What makes you think we want company?" she asked. "Perhaps we were looking forward to a leisurely, intimate trip, just the two of us, since we so rarely have any time alone?"
Cammon was not abashed in the slightest.
"I'll get my own room when you stay at an inn, and you know I'm useful when you have to camp out."
Taze glanced back at Seneth.
"Well, should we bring him?"
"I always earn my keep," Cammon said.
Completely without inflection, Taze repeated,
"He always earns his keep."
She couldn't keep the smile back any longer.
"Indeed he does, and I'm sure they'll be happy to see him again in Coravan. Let's saddle up 3 horses and be on our way."
Chapter 10 It seemed, at least the first week they were back at the convent, that the Lestra had forgotten Eleanor's existence, for which Eleanor was profoundly grateful. The new moon slowly resumed her gauzy silver garments, and every night more novices joined the group outside in the courtyard singing the pale lady's praises. Eleanor's work shifts rotated between kitchen duties, clean-up duties, a stint in the laundry, and many days spent in the fading garden. They had a spell of cold weather that made everyone else shiver but turned Eleanor hopeful. Winter could not come soon enough for her. She spent much of her free time thinking about her trip to Neft, which had held so many new experiences. The sumptuous Gieseltes mansion, the fine foods so casually served, the exhilarating walk alone through the city streets, marveling at all the shops. The encounter with Justin, that was what she thought about most of all. She was almost relieved when sickness moved through the convent and half the novices succumbed to cough and fever. Finally, an important task she could focus on that would require all her skill and energy. No more thinking about handsome young men who could end up dead if they so much as touched her hair. Daris was the senior daughter in charge of their day-to-day health, so she was the one who ran the infirmary. Anyone who volunteered to tend the sick was immediately relieved of other duties, but even so, there weren't that many girls who had the patience for nursing. Daris was always glad to get Eleanor's assistance, gladder still when Eleanor offered to take the night shift, as she always did.
"But wake me up if Leah gets any worse," Daris said, after running through a list of instructions that covered the 5 girls currently in the infirmary. "Everyone else is mostly just uncomfortable, but her fever is high enough to frighten me, and I don't think she's swallowed anything since noon. I don't think—but I've seen cases before—well, I'm worried, that's all.
I'll sit with her, Eleanor promised.
And Astir is none too strong either, Darris continued. But the others should all be well enough to go to their rooms tomorrow.
The plump older woman turned her head aside and produced a wheezing cough.
You're sick yourself, Eleanor exclaimed.
Darris waved a dismissive hand.
No, not sick. Too busy to be sick.
Sometimes sick doesn't care about busy, Eleanor said.
I'll be better in the morning.
After a few more exchanges, Darris left. Eleanor moved through the infirmary, checking the patients. Everyone sleeping, except Astira, who sighed deeply when Eleanor approached.
I feel horrible, she whispered. And I'm hot, and I can't fall asleep. Is there something you can give me? If only I could sleep.
Let me see what Darris left behind.
Eleanor picked through the pressed herbs and medicinal concoctions that Darris had mixed up, and then handed Astira a glass with a rather nasty-smelling liquid.
Drink that. I think it'll help.
She didn't really think it would, of course, but most people liked to believe they were drinking some kind of potion that targeted their illness.
Lie back,
she said next, and ran a cool cloth over Astira's warm forehead, sponging off her neck and shoulders. All the while, feeling the power of the Black Mother tingling through her fingertips, drifting over Astira's skin, sinking toward the bones. Astira sighed.
I do feel better, she said. I'm going to close my eyes. Will you be here when I wake up?
If you wake before morning.
All right, then,
Astira said drowsily, and not another word. Eleanor checked the other beds again, then settled beside Leah. She was probably no more than 16, a slight, delicate, fair-haired girl with a dreamy manner on the best of days. She was thin enough to make Eleanor suspect she had come from poverty, though she knew little about Leah's history. Frail enough to have a hard time fending off disease, had probably seen brothers and sisters die of just such a fever, might have barely survived a similar illness a time or two in her past.
Great Mother,
Eleanor whispered, laying her hands on either side of Leah's face.
Use my body to save this child.
She felt it again. The jolt of power, the steady stream of warmth and courage and strength. The waxing moon had set already. All Eleanor could see when she looked out was spangled night. The only goddess she could sense in the room with her was the Dark Watcher, hovering just at her back, her broad palms laid on Eleanor's shoulders. Eleanor felt a richness in her blood, coloring her skin, making her glow with an opal darkness. She pulled the fever from Leah's body into her own, and her hands felt momentarily hot. She drew the congestion from Leah's lungs, and briefly, Eleanor could not breathe. She stole the illness from Leah and held it tightly in her own arms until the Great Mother siphoned it away. Out into the cool night sky to dissipate between the stars. Leah stirred and seemed to smile, then turned on her pillow, her hand underneath her cheek. Eleanor felt the Dark Watcher withdraw, flowing from the room as if a wind had blown backward. Her own body felt curiously light, as if her bones had been ground up fine, and curiously heavy, so that she could scarcely move. She settled as comfortably as she could in the chair beside Leah and promptly fell asleep. In the morning, Eleanor woke when someone impatiently shook her shoulder.
Have you been sleeping here all night? Darris demanded. Look at you. Have you gotten up once to offer anyone a drink of water or another potion? I thought I could expect better of you, Eleanor. I am very disappointed.
Eleanor was groggy enough to wonder for a very brief moment exactly where she was. When she remembered, she felt a thin spiral of panic down her spine. She had slept the night through,
Leah had been sicker than she realized, because healing her had required enough energy to sap much of Eleanor's strength. She made a weak defense.
No, I checked on everyone when I first arrived, and then I...
She gave us most excellent care,
Astira spoke from across the room. She was sitting up in bed, yawning, and she looked completely recovered.
I had water several times in the night, and so did the others, didn't you?
Leah still slept, but the other three patients murmured quick agreements.
I feel quite well, thanks to Eleanor,
Astira added, and again the other three nodded. Indeed, they looked like they had never known a day's illness in their lives.
I just fell asleep here by Leah very late in my shift,
Eleanor said, lying, but not too worried about it.
But she was resting so comfortably that I thought I could close my eyes.
Darris looked slightly mollified.
Well, if she still has a fever, you'll be back here tonight, and you won't be sleeping.
But Leah, when examined, was so noticeably improved that even Darris's sour mood improved. The girl's breathing was easy. Her temperature was down, and when she woke, she could only produce a minor cough.
You'll stay here one more day, even so, Darris decided. Eleanor, if you want to redeem yourself...
I'll watch her tonight,
Eleanor said quickly.
Good. Then you go get some real sleep now, and I'll see you back here this evening.
But late that night, when Eleanor returned, rested and fed, since she had been absolutely starving once she left the sick room, she found a little crowd gathered in the infirmary. Leah was awake and fretful, in the way patients sometimes got right before they were completely well, tired of lying in bed but not quite so recovered that they had the strength to leave it. Leah's best friend, a short, pudgy redhead about Leah's age, was sitting cross-legged on the patient's bed, filling her in on events that had transpired while Leah battled a fever. Disposing themselves in various attitudes of relaxation on the other empty sick beds were Astira, Rosary, and two other girls, who clearly were bored enough to try for any kind of diversion.
I don't think Darris would be happy to see all of you here running the risk of getting infected, Eleanor said with some concern.
We'll be fine, Astira said. Most of us have already caught the fever and recovered.
Rosary, who had not, merely shrugged.
I'm not afraid of getting sick, she said.
Oh, please don't make them leave, Leah begged. I'm so bored. There's been nothing to do all day, and Darris just kept telling me to rest some more. I'm tired of resting.
How are you feeling?
Eleanor asked, and laid her hands on Leah's clear skin. No heat, no clutter in the blood.
Much better, I think.
So can we stay?
The redhead asked. Eleanor settled on the sick bed next to Astira.
I suppose so.
She glanced over at her friend.
Thank you for what you told Darris this morning, she said. I don't know why I slept like that. I never do in a sick room, and I'm glad everyone else survived the night while I was snoring.
Astira shrugged.
I felt so much better that I got up a few times and made sure everyone else had something to drink, she said.
You were sleeping so hard, but I could tell you'd done something to help Leah.
She splayed her hands and put a look of mischief on her face.
Some of that spooky Lyran stuff, I guess. You're always so good in a sick room.
Eleanor was silent, not sure how to answer, but Rosary offered a little laugh.
The Dark Watcher, her cousin said. Eleanor has a special place in her heart.
What's the Dark Watcher?
Leah asked. Astira already knew, since they had talked a little about their families when they first became friends. Before it had occurred to Eleanor that the Luminan Convent might not be the place to talk about other gods. Everyone waited for Eleanor to answer, so she smiled and tried to look completely guileless.
The Dark Watcher is also called the Black Mother, like the Pale Mother is sometimes called the Silver Lady,
Eleanor said in a light voice.
In the Lyrans, the Dark Watcher is the goddess that most people revere. She wraps her hands around us to keep us safe. She hides us from our enemies. She counts us every evening to make sure no harm has come to us while she was away on the other side of the world. She glanced around the room. Rosary was yawning, and Astira was faintly smiling, but the other girls were wide-eyed and fascinated. So Eleanor continued her story, telling it like some old half-forgotten myth, instead of the reality she lived with every day. There are certain women who have always seemed to have a deep connection to the goddess, she said, who seem to carry a special power of healing in their hands, a gift directly from the Black Mother. It is said that all these women are direct descendants of Mara, whom the goddess loved above all others. Why did she love Mara? Leah asked. Eleanor leaned her back against the wall to get more comfortable. Well, one day, many, many, many hundreds of years ago, Mara got up early to tend her garden. The sun had just risen, and none of the birds were stirring. No one else in the whole world was awake. But as Mara stepped into her garden, she saw a strange sight. A little girl lying in the dirt, so motionless that she might be dead. Mara hurried over and found the child still breathing but in very bad shape. She seemed to have fallen when she twisted an ankle and hit her head and maybe broken an arm. She was unconscious, she was bleeding, she was having trouble breathing, she was very close to death. Mara forgot all about her gardening. She carried that child inside and laid her on her own bed, and she tended her the entire day. She wrapped the girl's wounds and put honey on her tongue and sang her lullabies when the girl started crying. Once, when it seemed the child had almost stopped breathing, Mara put her mouth against the girl's and offered her own breath. When it seemed her heart might stop beating, Mara put her hand on the girl's chest and pressed that heart back into motion. From sun up till sundown, Mara did nothing but keep that girl alive. The minute the sun dropped below the horizon, a magnificent, dark-skinned woman strode into Mara's house. Mara had never seen her before, had no idea who this woman could be, yet she instinctively fell to her knees in awe. "You have saved my daughter's life," this woman said. "All day you have cared for her when I was far away and could not come to her side. Yesterday she was playing, and she ran from me and I could not catch her. I saw her fall, but I could not reach her. Already the sun was rising, and I had to flee to the other side of the world. I thought she would die before I could return. But you have saved my daughter's life." Well, then, of course, Mara realized that this terrifying stranger was the Dark Watcher herself. She bowed her head even lower to the floor and babbled out some kind of answer about how she was happy to be of service to the Black Mother, and the goddess said, "Hear me, Mara. For the gift of my daughter's life, which you have given me, I will present you a gift in return. For as long as you live, and the daughters born to your body, and their daughters and theirs, you shall be able to call on me. If you find someone bleeding and broken, or fevered and ill, you may raise your voice and pray, 'Great Mother, give this one a single night, and I will keep that soul alive one night, so that your human medicines have time to take hold.' No matter how close to death that person is, he or she will live at least until the next sunrise. Longer, if your skills succeed. I have promised this, and it is true." Eleanor paused, but there was utter silence in the room. Rosary still looked bored, but the younger girls were rapt, and even Astira seemed intrigued.
"And does that happen?" Leah asked. "Are there women among the Lyran folk who can keep someone alive like that?"
Eleanor smiled.
Well, it's just a tale, she said. I don't know anyone who's ever called on the goddess that way. But there are a number of gifted healers among the Lirin folk, and all of them give credit to the Black Mother. Do you? Astira asked abruptly. I mean, Leah. And that old woman in Neft? She was so sick until the night you nursed her.
We nursed her, Eleanor said sharply.
Well, I don't think I did anything except wipe her face down, but you were in the room with her first, and everyone knows how good you are in a sick room. Do you think you get some ability from this Dark Watcher, this Lirin goddess? Rosary was picking at her fingernails, not even interested in the conversation. It was still a wonder to Eleanor that her cousin could have so completely renounced the Black Mother within weeks of stepping inside the Luminan Convent. Rosary felt no fugitive fear, held no divided loyalties in her heart, was not at all worried that someone might discover she loved a goddess other than the Silver Lady.
I think that maybe the goddesses are sisters and hold each other in affection, Eleanor said.
She did not have to pray that the Black Mother would forgive her for what she was about to say. The Dark Goddess understood all about secrecy. She knew there were things best not confessed.
But only the Pale Mother has any power in Gilengaria. It is she we worship at Luminan Convent, and she who spreads her glory around us.
Astira sat back, seeming satisfied. Rosary flicked Eleanor one look of quick, sardonic amusement. She understood both the answer and the unspoken words, and returned her attention to her hands.
I don't think Darris or Chevelle would want to hear us talking about other goddesses, Leah said, hesitantly.
Certainly not,
Eleanor exclaimed, exaggerating her reaction so the other girls would laugh.
So, if you don't want to get me in trouble.
It's just a story, after all, the redhead said.
Just a tale, Eleanor agreed. So, Leah, are you sleepy yet? Should I chase everyone out of the room?
That's right, all of you, better go.
And tonight I will not fall asleep at my patient's bedside.
In a few minutes, the room had cleared, and Leah was drowsing on her pillow. And Eleanor was sitting upright in her chair, wondering what the jealous Silver Lady had thought of her story, and whether or not she would whisper tales in the Lestra's ear. 2 days later, the Lestra summoned Eleanor to her office. Eleanor's first thought, which left her tight with fear, was that Leah or Astira or one of the other girls had repeated her account of Mara and the Dark Watcher. But she was almost immediately relieved of this dread.
"Sit down, daughter," the Lestra invited her in a kind voice, and Eleanor took a seat.
She tried to look around without being too obvious. It was rare a novice had a chance to see the Lestra face to face or be inside this closed sanctum. The room was large and shadowy, swathed with black velvet hung from the ceiling and creating what was almost an indoor tent. Although there were candles placed in strategic corners, a large yellow glass globe in the center of the room was the primary source of light. Eleanor guessed it held 4 or 5 candles inside, although their light was so evenly dispersed that the sphere looked like a single round ball of creamy color. Dangling from the velvet overhead were silver chains hung with star-shaped charms and milky moonstones. Bookshelves and cabinets and storage chests made bulky shapes against the walls. The Lestra herself sat behind a large desk carved from some ebony wood. Eleanor faced her, perched primly in a straight-backed chair, Chevelle beside her in a chair that looked just as uncomfortable as Eleanor's.
"I have a special task for you to do," the Lestra continued. Her voice was so beautiful, it was almost hypnotic.
Eleanor found herself leaning forward a little just to hear it.
"I need you to return to the bedside of Paulina Nochlin."
She must have noted Eleanor's mystified expression, for she added,
Sarah Paulina is Janetta's mother, the sick woman you tended. Is she better? Eleanor asked. Indeed, so much so that she has been up and about the house, which proved to be unwise, since she lost her balance and fell. Oh, no. Did she hurt herself?
The Lestra nodded.
Broke her leg. A not insignificant injury for a woman her age, though the doctor says it will heal in time.
The Lestra glanced briefly at Chevelle, who sat there silent and thin-lipped. Eleanor thought Chevelle must not approve of whatever was coming next, which made Eleanor even more curious.
"The Sarah has requested the attendance of one of my novices to sit with her while she recovers and to help her with her prayers. Janetta said her mother was most adamant and will not be satisfied with the services of a maid or a girl from town. It must be a novice."
The Lestra inspected her. The hard, square face was impassive, but the black eyes were bright with intelligence.
"She specifically requested you." "Me? I don't think we spoke more than three words. The first night she was sleeping the whole time I was in the room. The second night she asked for a drink of water and then she wanted me to open the window. I didn't even tell her my name." "Nonetheless, she remembered you, and she described you to Janetta." "I am not normally eager to send my novices into the world to suit the whims of the nobility."
"It's ridiculous," Chevelle snapped. "Any servant girl would do to tend that old lady's wounds."
The Lestra inclined her head, as if in acknowledgement of Chevelle's words, but spoke as if they had not been uttered.
"And yet, Janetta is my cousin, and very dear to me. Her mother is sister to the Marlord of Nochlin, a very rich man. I think it would enable us to win powerful friends if we could grant this small request."
The musical voice held a questioning note, as if the Lestra was actually asking Eleanor if she was willing to take up this commission. Eleanor wouldn't have expected to have a choice in the matter, but if she did, it was certainly clear. To return to Neft, unguarded and unwatched.
"I would be happy to sit with your cousin's mother and help her raise prayers to the goddess," she said formally. "When would you like me to leave?"
"As soon as you gather your things," the Lestra said. Chevelle turned to Eleanor, her pinched face even tighter with warning.
"You will not speak with the guards who accompany you, except as required by courtesy or your own direct needs," she said. "You will remain inside the Giseltes house at all times. You will consider Janetta Giseltes to stand in my stead and obey her and give her respect. You will serve the Silver Lady with all honor, so that every report we hear of you will be full of praise."
"How long do you think I will need to stay there?"
"A week, perhaps," the Lestra replied.
"I am happy to go,"
Eleanor repeated.
"Good. Then pack your bags and meet Chevelle at the front door as quickly as you can. Carry the light of the Pale Mother with you, so that she shines on the ill, the infirm, and the sick at heart. Go gently with the goddess."
As it turned out, Sarah Paulina was not much interested in singing the Silver Lady's praises or having a convent novice say prayers with her while she lay, shivering and suffering, on her sickbed.
"You can pray all you like, but do it when I can't hear you,"
the old lady said 5 minutes after Janetta had left Eleanor in her mother's bedroom. It was early dark, since Eleanor's small party had arrived in Neft just as the sun was going down, and Janetta had wasted no time delivering Eleanor to her mother. Eleanor had set her travel bags down in the corner of the room, made a little curtsy when Janetta departed, then lit a single candle to set in the room's wide window. This would signal the Pale Mother that a soul of piety resided within. Then she had turned to the bed, where the old woman sat, one leg curled beneath her, the other one stretched out, wrapped
to immobility between a pair of splints.
"If you give me your hands, I will pray with you,"
Eleanor had said in a quiet voice.
Sarah Paulina